This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. For many people, North Carolina is a great place to live and work, but for others, the Tar Heel State is a place where it's rough to make ends meet, much less get ahead. For individuals teetering on the financial brink, building wealth and assets has become a distant dream. That's according to a recent scorecard by the Corporation for Enterprise Development. It shows North Carolina lagging behind in several areas, including the ability to build financial assets, increase income, and own a home. The figures are bleak for business ownership as well. In fact, the state ranks 43rd in small business ownership. And the numbers are even worse for the state's minority populations. White residents are twice as likely to own businesses as their non-white peers, and those businesses are worth more than three times the value of non-white-owned businesses. Carl Rist is the director of Children's Savings and a senior advisor on asset building at the Corporation for Enterprise Development. He's also one of the designers of the scorecard. Welcome, Carl. Good to have you here.
Good to be back, Frank. Thanks to be here.
Also, Christopher Gergen, CEO of Forward Impact, an organization that supports community-based strategies to develop high-impact entrepreneurs. Welcome back, Christopher. Good to have
you
as
well. Thank you very much,
Frank. Carl, let me start with you. You worked on developing this scorecard. What kinds of factors are you considering here?
So, and let me just tell you the story here. So, you know, the work we do at the Corporation for Enterprise Development is all about helping families to build wealth and protect that wealth. And as we get into that work, both at the community level, but also from a policy perspective, we found that across the country, there's really not a whole lot of data on wealth. There's a greatest source of data on income for families. But in terms of wealth data, there's not much. And so we created the scorecard as a way to help us create a baseline to understand how states were doing in helping families to build wealth and protect that wealth, and what kind of policies were in place to support that.
So talk about the measurements. What are you looking at? And maybe you make that distinction, because I think we often conflate those two ideas. We conflate income and wealth. They are not the same thing.
That's right. Income is what you have day to day to get by, right? Wealth is what you store up and you can use to invest in the future. And also to protect yourself in the present. If you have to face a crisis, having some wealth to be a cushion there is really a critical way to protect families when things get tough.
So you can convert income to wealth if you have some left over at the end of the month and put it in a place where it can grow, where
That's
it's
right.
building assets and financial security for you. If you're spending just about everything, or if you're deeply in debt, then the idea of building wealth becomes a lost dream almost.
That's right. And also wealth is so critical in helping families to think forward, right?
Yeah.
To think about investing in education, homes, businesses. And the truth is, too, you can't pass on your income check to your kids, but you can certainly pass on wealth.
Yeah.
And that's one way many families have built wealth over decades is those transfers from generation to generation.
So what are you measuring in the
scorecard? So the scorecard looks at assets from five different perspectives. So we measure, first of all, financial assets and income. This is like liquid wealth, checking, savings accounts, and so forth. We look at businesses and jobs. We look at home ownership, which is a critical way that most families in America build wealth. We also look at healthcare, which may sound odd to your listeners, but the truth is that families facing medical costs is a huge source of bankruptcies. And medical bankruptcy is probably half of the bankruptcies in America. So it's a huge risk factor for families without that support. And then, of course, education, right? Human capital is one of the main ways we build wealth as people to access jobs that pay well.
Get those jobs that pay well so you've got something at the end of the month to invest in that wealth that ultimately you pass on to your
Indeed.
Kids. Christopher, you've written about the numbers in North Carolina. Give us an overview.
Yeah, so they're not good, essentially. If you look across different measurement outcomes that Carl was just referring to, some of the things that you look at, for example, is that in our state, for example, more than half of our citizens at this stage of the game, if they lose their primary source of income, would be bankrupt in 3 months, which is a pretty stark number.
More than half.
More than half.
If they lost their primary source. Which, you know, if you think about that, when you said that, I thought about somebody getting laid off. But that means a person who retires on that income is 3 months away from bankruptcy.
Yeah, it shows you what a fine line the majority of our citizens are in North Carolina right now. Yeah. And it goes on from there. You know, only 33% of our residents actually have savings accounts at all, right? And only 64% of our residents own their homes. So we talk about ownership. And the challenge there, as we talk about non-white versus white, is that if you're white, you're 1.6 times more likely to own your home than if you're a person of color. So for the most vulnerable parts of our community, this idea of financial insecurity and financial vulnerability is a real problem and a real challenge. And I think is ultimately where one of our greatest vulnerabilities is as a state.
All right. Well, we're going to talk about some ways in which individuals can learn more about asset building and wealth building, maybe change some of their own ways of doing business at the personal level. But, Carl, I know that some of this relates to policy as well. Can you give us a sense of whether or not policy makes a difference in how people, individuals, build wealth or not?
It makes a huge difference. And certainly we can talk more about federal policy, and the federal tax code is probably the primary way we both create winners and losers in wealth building. Let's talk about state policy, which is what the scorecard focuses on. You know, North Carolina ranks 14th in the country for our policy index in the scorecard. So compared to our poor grades and outcomes, it would suggest some sort of success there in the state. And I think the truth is we've got a history of investing in some wise ways in home ownership, in business development, in things like family household security, right? But the truth is that I think that structure is kind of crumbling, right? So we've taken away our state earned income tax credit. We have not expanded Medicaid to families who would qualify in other states. And so we're seeing sort of a crumbling of this infrastructure. We have a housing trust fund to invest in affordable home ownership, but we're not investing a lot of money in it. Mm-hmm. So we see a state that's really beginning to disinvest in some key ways that have been the source of some support in a state that's, like much of the South, has been historically underperforming on some of these measures.
And if I can chime in there really quickly, Frank, in terms of the especially the uninsured numbers with Medicaid, and if you look at the expansion of that, if you were to compare where we would be, let's say if we were the same, the number one state with regards to insurance, which is Massachusetts, against this scorecard, which only has 4.3% of their households being uninsured, whereas North Carolina, we're 47th in the country as it relates to this, and 18.1%. But if we were like Massachusetts in terms of those percentage numbers, we would have over 1.1 million more insured households, which would make an enormous difference in terms of that kind of financial security and ability to be able to weather the storms in case you get sick.
Yeah, again, because of the shameful numbers of people who have been thrown into bankruptcy and destitution because of medical costs. Mm-hmm. And that goes up if you choose not to insure a half a million of your citizens, as we have done in the state. You make them more vulnerable. Well, let's talk about what happens at the personal level, too, and how nonprofits are also a part of the picture and trying to improve the picture. Glendola Massenburg-Beasley is president of the Durham Regional Financial Center. That's a group that works to help residents get out of debt and build assets. Glendola, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Tell us more about your work.
It's interesting in the sense that the families that we've heard Carl and Chris speak of are families who come to Durham Regional Financial Center. The services that we offer are primarily from a financial capability capacity standpoint of view, as well as those families who are interested in acquiring and achieving home ownership. Typically, however, though, they're coming to move into a wealth situation or trying to sustain or maintain their current situation. Their challenges, and it's difficult for them oftentimes to figure out the roadmap as to how they are able to achieve their goals of creating wealth for themselves or accumulating wealth. So what is it that we do? Basically, we're going to offer an opportunity for them to look at their day-to-day income and expenses, very, very basic services that they're needing to make sure that they have in place. We're going to also ask them to take a look at their credit, which is critical to their success as well. And of course, what type of consumer debt is in place? What's happening? The very, very basic kinds of things. So we're looking at, again, what we're calling the financial capacity coaching piece, which is very different than the counseling, which has been in the past. We know that counseling pretty much will teach a person the financial literacy pieces, how to budget, how to save, how to manage their debt. But now it's moving into coaching basically on the behavioral side. We're going to take the knowledge that they've gained and now put it into action. And so from a grassroots standpoint of view, we want to want people to hold themselves accountable for the decisions that they're making as they're moving from knowledge to action.
Well, tell us more about that behavioral side and that kind of coaching. Coaching about what?
Coaching pretty much about their financial ability, about their financial security, about their financial independence. And let me just give you some real examples about the kinds of things that we would suggest, because it's it's not that difficult. Imagine where we could get a family who would save as much as $1 a day. The family who has no savings whatsoever. it's the habit, it's the beginning of and the mindset of moving into the pattern of saving. And so if they're saving $1 a day, if they are taking the change that they're bringing home on a daily basis, if they're depositing that change in those funds into a clear water bottle, they now have a visual thermometer as they can see that began to grow. It's just that simple, and it's just that basic. So it's a mindset that I want to move from spending to saving.
That's part of the picture. And so who comes to you? Because that would be somebody who has a dollar a day to save, and I'm guessing not thousands of dollars of debt to also address before they can, you know, sort of get back to that piggy bank and invest that, right?
Most often the customer or the client who's coming to our agency is going to bring us anywhere from about 10 or more consumer debt accounts. And we're looking at an average of about $30,000 or more. The profile, however, is even changing, whereby those families are typically going to be in the range of about a $25,000 annual income. Now we're seeing families who are coming to us with six-figure incomes.
Wow.
And why has that profile changed? It's because the lack of reserve and the lack of savings that were set aside to be able to carry them through the challenges that they're faced with. We speak about home ownership. We're working very, very diligently and very hard with our state entity to be able to help folks save their home from foreclosure. There is a huge foreclosure rate that has taken place since 2008. And those families are coming due to no fault of their own. They've lost their job. They've lost their income. And the rainy day fund was not there to catch them as they were in the transitional stage of looking for new employment. As they're looking for new employment, yes, many of them have certainly gained employment, but the rate of pay now is different or less than what it was before. So families are really, really at a vulnerable state at this point in time, trying to make that transition of sustaining themselves.
So and to what extent do medical, we've been talking about medical costs and the problem of being uninsured, how big a part does that play in the stories of people who come to see you?
Oftentimes, that's the number one reason why families find themselves in such a crisis because there has not been the ability to gain or garner insurance for themselves. And so now they're left with the debt of that medical bill and they're unable to make that payment or to pay for the medical needs that they currently have. So it's a huge piece of what we're seeing.
Carl, as you look at the scorecard, we've talked about, you know, some of these behavioral changes, just a little bit of training, understanding what savings is and getting into the habit of doing it. Is that, would that do it? Would that get us climb the ladder and be in a better position if that's all we did?
Certainly, that's an important way to start. And I love connecting the work that Condola is doing on the ground, helping individual families save a little bit, to have a little bit to stock away for the future is what does it. Or where we start. But I think state policy has got to do a better job of helping us to support families as well. As we mentioned before, we have an earned income. We had a state earned income tax credit. That was a great way the families got a lump sum back every year. That's gone. And so I think that's an important state policy that we need to bring back to North Carolina to create that ability to save. I want to go back to we mentioned earlier, federal tax policy, right? And so in addition to these kind of individual behavioral things, I think there is a structural thing we got to address. And that goes back to the federal tax code. So we've done some analysis, and our analysis shows that $620 billion a year is spent through the federal tax code to build wealth for families in things like homes and retirement accounts, which is appropriate, right? But the truth is that, and this is, the home mortgage deduction, pension fund exclusions, and so forth, but the truth is that the top 10% and 1% of this country get about $33,000 a year in tax benefits through these programs, right? Families in the bottom 20% get about $70. So we've got an upside-down tax system that does help families build wealth, but those with means get the most, and that's got to change.
Well, I think that's an important point, Christopher, that those really help people. If I have enough money to make a down payment on a house and still feed my family and meet my medical needs, then I get the deduction for mortgage, the mortgage deduction. If I don't have that much money to begin with, I don't get that.
Yeah,
if I didn't put money in a retirement fund because I've been making $25,000, $35,000 a year, that doesn't help me. So you're talking about a tax code that does maybe has some real good benefits and good reasons for allowing those kinds of benefits, but they're going to people who already have wealth.
Yeah, I mean, it goes also to this whole question of ownership, right? Who are the owners in our society? Where is that going? And to go back to Glendola's point about net worth, right? This most recent Pew Research Center report came out, basically said the median net worth of black households in 2011 was $6,400, which went down 10% from 1984. In contrast to that, if you look at the median net worth for whites, it's at $91,000, $91,405, which has gone up 11% in the same time period. So it precisely, the data is there, and I think we have to be paying close attention to what we're going to be doing about that at the state level.
Home ownership and business ownership. Talk more. I mean, you started to talk about disparities in business ownership, and again, this is real wealth building that can be transferred to the next generation.
In that same Pew report, for example, if you look at where the equity was for white households, business equity is number two in terms of the equity that they own in their own homes, which they benefit from through federal tax code. If you look at the same thing for non-white households, it is the second lowest equity class with only 4% in terms of business equity. So there are dramatic differences here and disparities, and I think it really puts a challenge out there for these kinds of communities that are ultimately getting blocked out of a lot of the systems that are designed to grow wealth in our society.
What are some of the other barriers to business ownership? Is it the same? Do we use the same means, just start saving a little bit at a time, or are there other barriers to business ownership?
I think there are actually some systemic barriers, right? We talk about this idea of real estate ownership. We have a history of redlining, for example, which is specifically blocking out lower income communities of color from access to traditional home mortgages and into communities in which you see the mortgage rates actually appreciating over time. The other is access to capital, right? So one of the key issues around access to friends and family capital, access to traditional bank loans, those are often, if you're a low income person of color trying to get a business off the ground, often those avenues aren't available to you. So we really have to fundamentally think about this idea of access to capital, access to some of these traditional lines. One of the things that Carl's working on in terms of children's savings accounts is one nice vehicle for that, to try to help more families actually start to take a proactive approach to savings that get them into a system where they get the training, where they can get the job, where they can get themselves out of this financial vulnerability. I think we have to be thinking about this in really systemic ways. And what Glendola is working on in terms of this place-based strategies, where we can take holistic approaches around collective impact coupled with smart tax policy at the state and the federal level, is ultimately how we're going to get ourselves out of this hole.
Carl, tell us more about those savings accounts now for young people.
Yeah, so there's a growing movement around the country to help kids in the very early ages to start building small savings accounts with an initial deposit and matches to help them save long-term for college. Remarkably, the city of San Francisco and St. Louis both provide a savings account for every child that enters public kindergarten. We are doing something very similar here in Durham starting this this January in Y.E. Smith Elementary School, and that's the elementary school that serves the targeted census tract that Mayor Bell has identified for an anti-poverty effort that Glendola and I are both very deeply involved in.
So, is there a public commitment to that, or is it all nonprofits?
So right now, the public is supporting the effort. I think what we want to show is that by having these accounts for all kids at Y.E. Smith, this is going to, we hope, change the sort of thinking and the mindset of those children about the future and college and why that's important and why it's accessible. Glendola is doing similar work with families there, doing deep counseling on financial credit and budgeting. And so we hope to show that success in the Census Tract 1001 will be a basis for the city expanding this work citywide. And that will take some important city investments.
I think that will be a great model, Frank, neighborhood by neighborhood, showing the success that can take place in 10.01, the census tract there. And certainly we want to appreciate our mayor for taking the leadership on that. Grassroots organizations are working with the Eastern Children's Initiative. And as Carl has mentioned, our organization will be working with the families there, not only with the children and the children's savings account, but we certainly want the parents to also be able to participate in a savings plan as well. What we're finding is that many of the families will need the basics of opening a checking account, establishing banking relationships, understanding the process for home ownership. We'd like to work with them on the IDA program, which is the individual development account, where they save, and of course their savings are matched. And so there are an array of services and programs that are available to help begin to start from the bottom up and make sure that we create some behaviors that create wealth.
So So it's going to be important that when this grassroots effort succeeds and people have taken responsibility for their own savings, that there's the structure in place and the policies in place that will support the future of that. Because obviously,
absolutely,
it's not just it's not on us, but as you say, everything has to be in place. Well, I want to thank you all for being on the program today. Glendola Massenburg Beasley is president of the Durham Regional Financial Center. Christopher Gergen, CEO of Forward Impact. Carl Rist, director of Children's Savings, and a senior advisor on the asset building at the corporation that we've talked about today on the State of Things, the Corporation for Enterprise Development. Thank you all for being on the program.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Thanks, Frank.
Coming up, Daily Show co-creator Liz Winstead talks with us about her upcoming comedy appearances in North Carolina. Stay with us.